Alpine Authors on Park Radio. A look at some of the great books being written by and for the Bow Valley.
Hi, and welcome to Alpine Authors. I'm Alan Buckingham. There's a certain mystery to the mountains. That was especially true in the early days of European exploration of the Canadian Rockies. But what if there were still mountains out there waiting to be discovered? The debut novel by Canmore author Jerry Auld, Hooker and Brown, asks that very question, even as it explores the journeys of some of the early explorers in this part of the world. With me in the studio to talk about his book, as well as our exploration of the mysterious, is Jerry Auld. Hi, Jerry, and welcome to Alpine Authors.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Now, off the top, I sort of feel like I should state that it sort of feels to me like you wrote this book for me. It has pretty much everything I'm into packed into one story. History, geology, climbing, mountaineering, philosophy, storytelling. It was pretty cool. But I'm guessing you didn't really actually write it for me. So where did your inspiration come from for the book?
Actually, a long time ago, so this is 16 years ago, I was reading The Canadian Alps by Robert Sanford, and that's where I had first come across the story of Hooker and Brown, and I was really intrigued by it, mainly because I was climbing a lot at the time, reading everything I could, and I was stunned that there was all these stories that I knew nothing about in my own backyard. So I, you know, put that away, went traveling for a long time, and when I came back to Canada and moved to Canmore, because it was the best place I could find in the whole world, the story just wouldn't leave me. And so I started to write about it, and it kind of grew. It didn't start off with all those aspects.
Yeah, it was you know, sort of neat for me as I'm, you know, sitting there reading the book, and I'm just like, wow, this is just cool. It's like, are those all things you're interested in too, or did they just sort of fit in to help make the book what you were looking for?
Well, the funny thing about the story is that the more I explored it, the more aspects to it. You know, there was Arthur Coleman was a geologist who first came out, and the geology of the mountains was something that I was interested in, but I saw different angles of being able to tell the story that way because of the mountains, because of what they are. And the philosophy and everything else just started to tie in at different levels. And so I started off thinking it might be a short story, and it grew into a novella, and after a while it realized it had to be a novel and it had to have all these aspects.
Cool. So the book is the story of Rumi, who's a geology student and a climber who's working on the trail crew in K Country. And he gets fascinated by this story of Hooker and Brown, sort of like you did. And there are two of the mountains that were at one point believed to be the highest in North America. But to me, that's sort of the overt plot line. The book's also a story of relationships and personal discovery. Can you talk a bit about that side of the book for me?
Yeah, well, I was really fascinated, not only the fact that these mountains, the story existed and I didn't know anything about it, but once when I was on trail crew, I did see in a storm up on a ridge, I did see this mountain that was just enormous. And I ran back all excited, and it turned out it was Assiniboine. And I realized there was a connection between Hooker and Brown and this mountain that I had seen, that I still believed and still wanted to see mountains that didn't exist. And so I started to get into the relationships of the old climbers and wondered how they had been motivated and why they walked away from it, and trying to understand how different people see these peaks in their lives, and using that as a metaphor of the main things that drove them, not just within their relationships, but within their own lives.
So how much of the book is you? How much is it your personal story, or close to that story, that you're retelling through some of the characters?
Yeah, well, they say write what you know. I was on trail crew for 2 years in Kananaskis Country, which gave me an enormous amount of material, but all the characters are fictional, except for the historical characters. I have climbed all the mountains that are described in the book, partly for research, which was nice. You know, good excuse to go climb. But all of it is different from what I actually climbed, in terms of weather, in terms of success, in terms of everything. It's fiction, so I had a great amount of leeway to change things around and turn it around. But all of the subplot lines were imagined. None of that has got anything to do with me.
You could sort of tell, though, that the description of the climbing was, well, not necessarily specifically real of that instance, definitely based on experience and from somebody who knows what they're doing and has been out a lot.
Yeah, and to this day, I don't consider myself a climber. I consider myself a writer. And that actually took me years to kind of work out in my mind, because what was happening is I'd go climbing and I was so amazed at the inner struggle and the everything around you and everything that happens when you climb. But even on the hardest parts, there'd be 20% of my mind who is being a writer, recording it, which is great to daydream when you're, as a writer, but very dangerous as a climber. And eventually I realized, no, I'm a writer. This is what I'm doing, is recording this as I go up. And that was part of my way of internalizing the effect of climbing on myself.
Very interesting. So there's a lot of history in Hooker and Brown. And you sort of approach it by having Rumi tell the stories of the early explorers. Why did you want to go about doing it that way, having somebody tell the stories?
Well, I tried writing it, you know, realizing that there was a lot of history that I needed to get down as the base of the story. I thought that was really, really important. And the more I did the research into these early climbers, the more I was amazed at what they had actually pulled off without any roads or any maps or anything. It was stunning. So I really wanted to include them. But just coming out of the narrative and stating some history, or front-loading the whole book with the history, really felt it dragged it down. So I thought it would be more fun is to find it out the way I found it out, which was by people telling me stories and passing that along that way. And I found that gave it more dynamic between the characters as well, where they could tell each other stories and twist them with their own characteristics.
Absolutely. Like, I thought that was a great aspect of the book, is you've got this history coming out, but it's through people discovering it and being amazed about it, and you sort of get more amazed than you might have been because you've got the amazement of the characters too.
Right, and the stories, you know, I didn't want anything to be factual, because the whole point of the book is to say, what if what we think is fact, these maps that overlay the land, what if they're wrong, like really wrong? Not just the wrong distortions that we all know about and things that are missing, but what if they're really wrong? And so when a character tells a story, it's not just secondhand, it's third hand. You know, their whole influence is telling the story the way they heard it or want to hear it. And so that all ties into the book too, with the layers of distortion.
And it, you know, makes me wonder how much of the history is actually true. You know, you're reading it and they tell the stories, but how much is them and how much is what was there?
And the only way we know that is through their accounts. So yeah, that's a big open question. It was really fun to write the historical parts of the book because I had to stay true to the characters and I had to stay true to the historical record. But there's so many gaps that you could play within, and that's what I tried to do.
And so you did try to stay true to that historical record. So a lot of that, the history, the stories we're hearing is... Or is it based on a lot of fact? Like, you know, when I'm hearing the story of Coleman and where he went and what he did, how much of that is what actually happened and how much of that is the characters adding to it?
Well, all of it actually happened, but the scene that I describe it in is going to be fictionalized to the point where, you know, I don't know what he actually said when he finally came to the punch bowl, but I can imagine it. And through all his letters and writings, I have a really good idea. And it, from the book he wrote. So within the book, I've used letters that are historically accurate letters, and others that I've made up, and I'm not going to tell you which ones. Hopefully that they're you know, you can't tell them apart.
But you can't, and that's part of why I was asking, is because, you know, I've now framed my reference of these characters based on the stories that were in the book, as well as other stuff I've read too. But it was, you know, part of me is trying to figure out, well, you know, how did it really go? And you never know.
But. No, but I was trying to be neutral in terms of my judgments on the characters. And I was using, if there was anything overtly judgmental, it was coming right out of the historical record that one person wrote about another this way. But I had such respect after researching all of them. You know, at times I'd like James Outram more than Colley. And then other times I thought Colley was the coolest guy. You know, he just climbed everything with good style. But at the end of it, I realized, you know, I can't judge any of these guys. They're all incredible people. And so I wanted to stay, in the historical sense, I wanted to stay as neutral as I could, maybe infer some of the story and where the mystery came from, but ultimately respect who they were.
And it must have taken a lot of research. How much time did you have to spend going through stuff, finding these accounts, the letters, in order for you to even get to writing some parts of this book?
Well, I think I was lazy at the start because I just wanted to write a short story about how these mountains were moving me. It was a long, drawn-out process. What would happen is I would do a bit of research, as little as I had to, and realize, no, this is something bigger. Or a key thing would pop in and realize I had got that character all wrong. So I'd have to go back and dig into him, and it just kept unearthing more and more layers. And so, yeah, I spent a lot of time in the library and University of Calgary and the White Museum here, which is like a fantastic archives. but also online. You know, there's a lot of Scottish history. The Hudson's Bay companies all got their records online. And the other thing I love about online is that you can search for something and miss it completely, but something else turns up that, and it's because it's fiction. I don't have to have fact. I just have to have something inspirational that ties in. So I found a whole bunch of stuff that I was not expecting, including that I'm related to the guy that was in charge of the Hudson's Bay Company in 1811 when Thompson crossed the pass. Wow. We're a direct descendant 7 generations. And that just popped out a few years ago.
Huh. And how long did the whole process take you? I mean, you started with a short story at one point in time, and you end up with this book that came out this fall. You know, how long a process was it?
If I'm honest to count it up, it's 14 years since I started that short story. It'd been bouncing around in my head when I was traveling for a year or so. But, you know, I took time off from it. I spent a lot of time writing short stories, basically improving my craft and learning how to write and how to tell the story, and getting down to the courage to say, yeah, this is a novel and it needs to be done with and the proper research and everything else.
And so the history part, you mentioned earlier that you were interested. You heard some of the stories of the earlier climbers here when you were climbing. And is history something you were into before that? Or is it just something you're into now? Or
yeah, I studied at university. I did a minor in history. And I was always amazed at it because of the stories and stuff that I just didn't know. But I always liked it because you could tell it in story as opposed to just facts and timelines. But what I was most surprised at is how little I knew about the Canadian Rockies, where I grew up. You know, this is our own backyard. And there was there still is an enormous amount of material and stories out there, which I feel are left untold.
And so was it just the openness of the Hooker and Brown story, the incompleteness that drew you to that specifically, or what really was the drawing point to Hooker and Brown as your focal point?
I just kept feeling that there was this amazing thing that was lost in our modern world, which was the white spaces on maps and not, you know, being able to go to a place. Say you went to Lake Louise, for instance, right? But you've never seen a photo of it, never heard anyone talk about it, never seen a drawing or a film on TV or a movie or advertisements. And you walk in, even with all the stuff that we have seen, it's incredible to stand there for the first time and see it. But what if you'd never seen anything and you couldn't take a picture? You had to come back and tell people about it. I just felt like the mystery of the place and the essence of the place was enhanced much, much more that way when you see it for yourself for the first time and you have to work to get it. And so I thought these two mountains really represented something maybe lost in us that we can still connect with. And there's no reason it can't still be there in terms of reversing the mystery, you know, making it more mysterious as opposed to trying to solve it and walk away maybe disappointed.
Yeah. Yeah, and I must admit, after, you know, going hiking, after having finished reading the book, I was sort of like, you know, what if I didn't follow this trail? What if I just tried to get to the pass my own way? And it, you know, it did get me thinking in the, you know, what would it have been like if I didn't read about the whole description of the trail before coming out? You know, where is that mystery and what does that mean to me?
Yeah, and I had found that with myself. You know, whenever I was climbing or scrambling, I'd look at the guidebook, I'd grab the topo and the route map, and the maps were always a part of my life and I've always loved maps. But I started to realize that in my travels and also in the Rockies, you know, you realize, hey, that cliff isn't on the map and now it's really screwed up our day. That there's distortions. There's things that are not on the maps. And if you have enough distortions in the right situation all accumulate at the same time, you can have a really big distortion. And I kept thinking, what if you could distort something that would hide a mountain? What if? I mean, that would be neat, right?
Absolutely. And what if? But we got to take a bit of a break here. When we get back, though, we'll delve a bit more into the mystery of Hooker and Brown with author Jerry Auld.
Alpine Authors on Park Radio will be right back. Now back to Alpine Authors. Only on Park Radio, 101.1 FM.
Hi, and welcome back to Alpine Authors. I'm Alan Buckingham. I'm here with the author of Hooker and Brown, Jerry Auld. So, Jerry, one thing I noticed pretty early in the book is that your characters don't have any names, per se. They're called either by descriptive words or their employment titles. What was your reason for doing this? Like, why did you want to do that?
I suppose there was a few reasons. One was personal, just thinking that our names seem arbitrary at times, as opposed to, you know, when we were kids playing Cowboys and Indians, it always seemed like they had really cool descriptive names that were very characteristic of the person. And in a lot of cultures around the world, when you come of age, that you get a new name, one that describes who you really are. And of course, in any spiritual quest, people often come back with a new name. But I also found that names tend to be maps. They're a map of a person. And personally, when I would read books and I'd hear on page 4, the character is introduced as Tom and described, by page 10, I couldn't tell you who Tom was or what he looked like. He was just a word. And I felt I didn't want to do that. I wanted my characters to always be connected with their characterization. So in other words, take away the maps. And at the start of the book, it may be awkward, but I'm hoping by the end of it, it all makes sense why I'm doing that and how it all ties together. Because the whole idea is to strip away the maps and see what the land really is.
Well, absolutely. And I mean, you even spend time with the main character exploring different names for some of the other characters and other people he's interacting with. And you even use multiple names for characters sometime and different types of rock as he's a geologist. And it was an interesting way to get more insight into the characters too.
Yeah, I felt like every time I mentioned the name of a character in that sense, I don't have to re-describe him. That it gives a lot of the sense of himself. And the hardest one was actually the name of the narrator, because I needed some way to refer to him in a conversation of three people. I needed a way to actually refer to back to the narrator. And so that was the hardest one. But it actually tied in, I thought, really well in the novel and in many different levels by calling him Rumi.
For sure. And now I want to talk a bit about one of the characters in specific, mm-hmm. the lion.
Yep.
Where did the idea for the lion come from?
Originally, the lion, I had a partner on trail crew named J.T. Gill, who's now the assistant fire chief in Canmore. And, you know, he was big guy, funny guy, and real hard worker. And I guess originally I wanted a character in that place to, as the lion, to be someone that embodied a lot of the lion's aspects. And visually, when I was first writing it, I imagine JT was the kind of character. Of course, that morphed completely out of, you know, anybody, but that was the original seed of it. I mean, a lot of stuff when you're writing, I think, comes from stuff you've experienced personally, and then you take it and blend it with a lot of other experiences until it's totally unrecognizable.
Yeah, and it's really the philosophical aspect of the lion that goes with this, you know, tough, strong climbing guy, and it was an interesting combination of characteristics. Why did you throw all of that together? Do you know? Is that just the way it worked? Like,
partly, yeah. It's bring a lot of things together, and it crystallizes into a character. I was very interested in the philosophy angle. I had studied a lot of philosophy and read a lot of philosophy, and the early Greeks, their attitudes toward what mountains could be in terms of the ideal or what's actually manifest on the ground, I thought was really, really important. I wanted to bring that in. But a lot of climbers these days have more of the existentialist attitude. You know, I'm here, I got to do my thing, and I'm responsible for my own well-being and my own life. And so I thought this is really cool, that the difference between the modern existentialists and the ancient Greeks, and the lion was the perfect vessel for me to bring that together and have a guy who's working trail crew, probably far overqualified, but pondering these questions and trying to figure out his own story.
Well, and it really worked, because there's a certain certain amount that rings true when you've got somebody who's super overqualified, but really just wants to be present and to figure out what else is going on with their life.
Yeah, and I thought, you know, the philosophical questions, the really deep ones, have never really been answered, which is great because you can keep asking them. But for him to claim to be an existentialist, you know, to say, I'm going to be out here and I'm going to do my thing, but really be nagged deep in his heart that he's more like an ancient Greek, thinking that he really wishes there's an ideal out there that he can live up to, and not quite living up to it, I thought was a really neat way of giving some tension to that character and bringing him into the story with it for his own reasons for wanting to go to the pass.
Absolutely. And I mean, I found all the characters interesting and whatever, but I really kept wanting to be inside the head of the lion. But you never give us that opportunity. Did you ever think about changing perspective in the book at all?
Yeah, I did. I actually wrote a full draft in second person, trying to make the reader, you know, see if I could make that work. And it was a bit cumbersome. But I found third person to be able to go into different people's heads wouldn't work at all. And also, I thought that the narrator had to be Rumi. It had to be. There's no other way it was going to work. To be able to look from other people's perspectives completely. That wasn't the story that was being told. So no, the lion became, in a way, an enigma itself.
Well, I mean, to me, it ends up being part of what I enjoyed about the book is there are still these unanswered questions, and I never get to find out why some of the other characters were doing what they were doing. But, you know, as you're going through the book, and it works really well being in Rumi's head all the time, but I'm just like, I wish I had known that a little bit more. And I guess that's what you want as an author.
I do,
people,
yes.
You know, wanting more at the end.
Absolutely. And the books that I've most enjoyed reading are the ones when I get to the last page and I really want more. And I did set out to try and achieve that. But I also wanted the idea of mystery being endless. You know, that you never get to know everything. The more you know, the more mystery that's out there.
I often hope, not really, but that at the end of a book, though, that there's no more mystery, that it all gets cleared up. But there never really is.
No, I wanted to, in this book, I really wanted to tie everything together that I had introduced in the stories and the characters. And the ending, to me, was a place that would bring everything all together. But I didn't want to solve the mystery. I wanted to bring it all together at the same time, exploding it all apart and realizing that, yeah, there's a lot more out there than we, you know, believe in our dreams.
Absolutely. So now the book Hooker and Brown has recently been shortlisted for the Boardman Tasker Prize for Mountain Literature. What was that like for you when you found out?
It's mind-blowing. I mean, it's a debut novel for me. It just came out. And at this, you know, point, you're just looking for people to get interested in, to read it. And suddenly, you know, an international award pokes up and shortlists. So to go over to the UK and actually to you know, attend the festival at Kendall. It's incredible feeling, humbling a little bit. The scope of everything just got a lot bigger. Things just suddenly got international. But at the same time, thrilling, because it's not about me per se. It's to get this story out, you know, the story of the Southern Rockies and our history, to get that more widely known. And that right there is success.
So you are going then?
Oh, yes.
Well, I didn't, you know, you never know. It's a long way.
It's a chance of a lifetime.
True enough. And it's a pretty impressive short list of writers, too. Another Bow Valley writer, Chick Scott's in there, and world-renowned mountaineer Steve House. Seems your book is doing pretty well for itself.
Yeah, well, definitely the competition's stiff and respectful. I mean, it's fantastic that I can write something that's, you know, on par.
Absolutely. And for me, when I was looking at the list, I just thought it was pretty cool. We got two people from the Bow Valley for this International Book Award. Like, that's...
Yeah, very well represented. And would be love to bring that award back here. I'm happy to see myself up there. It's the only book of fiction on the list. And so, you know, and I think it's got something really fundamental to say about the mountains. So I have high hopes.
Well, and to me, that's part of the elements of the book that, well, it is a book of fiction, there's so much that rings true to anybody who's ever spent time in the Canadian Rockies. So, yeah, I think it's got a lot going for it. Now, before I let you go, we're getting close to the end here, but there's a question from the book that I really have to ask you. All the main characters at some point get asked what their two mountains are. What are the two ideals they aspire to? So, Jerry, what do you Hooker and Brown?
Should I answer that? Yeah, I asked myself that question a very long time ago, and I would have to say position and purpose. It's the same as saying altitude and momentum. I just feel like in my life, I would like to position myself exactly where I want to be, but realizing that in order to do that, you need a purpose. If you look at it in terms of altitude and momentum, it's like an orbit, and you can't maintain your orbit without a certain amount of momentum. Without the momentum, you can't get to the orbit you want. And so those two, to me, are the two peaks, and neither are higher. They're fundamentally entwined.
Cool. Well, Jerry, I really enjoyed the book, and thanks for stopping by to talk about it with me, and good luck in the Boardman Tasker Prize for Mountain Literature.
Thank you.
Well, that's it for the show this week. If you missed part of the interview, or you just want to listen to it again, you can download the show by heading to friendsofbanff.com and clicking the podcast link. If you'd like to pick up a copy of Jerry Auld's book, Hooker and Brown, visit The Bear and the Butterfly at 214 Banff Avenue. Alpine Authors can be heard each week at this time on Park Radio. Tune in next week to hear from another Alpine author.
Alpine Authors, only on Park Radio, 101.1 FM.